United States versus Dekoff. Ms. Strong.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Amy Strong, and I, along with my co-counsel, James Dasso and Anna Downs-Temple, represent the appellant, Michael Dekoff. We're here today to ask that you reverse Mr. Dekoff's conviction and grant him a new trial for three reasons. First, the district court abused its discretion when it allowed the government to present highly inflammatory details about a prior kidnapping as part of its case in chief. These details were irrelevant to Mr. Dekoff's insanity defense, and they resulted in immediate and decisive unfair prejudice to the defendant. Second, the district court abused its discretion when it allowed a government expert to testify that Mr. Dekoff said he knew it was wrong to kidnap Ms. Wagner. This amounted to an impermissible inference on the only issue in this case, Mr. Dekoff's sanity. And third, the district court erred in refusing to give an instruction on the true consequences of a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity. This instruction was warranted after the same government expert testified that Mr. Dekoff believed he could just get time served for the kidnapping. With respect to our first point of error, the probative value of the testimony about the prior kidnapping was substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effect. The only contested issue in this case was whether Mr. Dekoff was insane when he kidnapped Ms. Wagner, and that testimony was irrelevant to that sole issue. Right off the bat, the district court got it wrong when it found that the testimony was admissible to prove Mr. Dekoff's intent, plan, preparation, and knowledge in kidnapping Ms. Wagner. That was not a contested issue in this case. Mr. Dekoff had already admitted that he did indeed kidnap Ms. Wagner, so the testimony was not relevant to that issue. As this court has recognized in cases like United States versus Miller, prior bad acts are not admissible to establish issues that are not in contest until the defendant affirmatively contests such issues.
What about when insanity is the issue? Don't you get to plan, intent, knowledge, and isn't there something to be said for making that kind of an exceptional circumstance
The only way that a prior act would be relevant in the context of an insanity defense is if it could establish that the defendant either was not suffering from a mental disease or defect when he committed the act with which he was charged, or if it could show that the defendant appreciated the nature and wrongfulness of his conduct when he committed the act with which he was charged. There is no way that this prior kidnapping from 20 years earlier was going to prove either of those things. As an initial matter, the government never introduced any evidence showing that Mr. Dekoff was punished or convicted in any way for this prior kidnapping, so it was not going to show that he should have known or understood that it was wrong 20 years later to kidnap Ms. Wagner. And this testimony did not touch on whether Mr. Dekoff was or was not suffering from a mental disease or defect when he did indeed commit this kidnapping 20 years later.
Was that ever a defense in the 87 kidnapping?
Excuse me?
Was his mental capacity a defense in the 87 kidnapping?
I believe that it ended up being an issue in the 87 kidnapping because he was ultimately, if my recollection is correct, convicted, and then it was reversed on some issue relating to his insanity during that first kidnapping. So tangentially, yes, it was
an issue. Is competency to stand trial or is actual mental condition state at the time of the kidnapping?
Your Honor, I can't recall right now. I'd be glad to submit a supplemental brief to address that. I just can't quite recall. But I do know that in this case, the government didn't present any evidence as to his state of mind when he committed that prior kidnapping 20 years earlier. The only thing they presented...
Well, so you're presumed to be acting sane and be rational. That's a defense. Insanity or mental disease or defect is a defense to offer. So if that defense wasn't offered in 87, I have a hard time understanding why he's charged in a new kidnapping case, which is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you concede that the great similarities between the two, that wouldn't be relevant on his intent and whether he knew right from wrong in the newer case.
I mean, we would absolutely agree that it's not at all relevant to his intent, plan, preparation, or even state of mind 20 years later. Moreover, in addition to being irrelevant, this testimony was highly prejudicial. As I said before, the government introduced inflammatory details about the prior kidnapping, elicited in large part from the mouth of the victim herself. These details included things like that he forced the victim's 15-year-old brother to assist him in the prior kidnapping and then made the brother walk home barefoot and barely dressed, that he forced the victim to sit undressed on a hotel toilet while he showered so he could prevent her escape, that he kept a gun on the nightstand next to the bed in the hotel that night while they slept, and that the victim had a subjective belief she might die during the course of this kidnapping. Your Honor, these were not details of the act with which Mr. Dekoff was actually charged. These were details of a kidnapping committed 20 years earlier that were irrelevant to the sole issue in this case, whether Mr. Dekoff was insane. Moreover, the government maximized the prejudicial effect of this testimony by presenting it as part of their case in chief. By preemptively presenting what was really rebuttal testimony, the government here effectively pre-seasoned the jury to be prejudiced against Mr. Dekoff's insanity defense. As the United States Supreme Court has recognized in cases such as Old Chief, a prior bad act carries the particular risk that a jury will convict someone simply for being a bad person. And that is exactly what happened here. The government presented this highly inflammatory testimony about the prior kidnapping, which then resulted in a jury who was scared to death before they ever even got a chance to hear the details of Mr. Dekoff's insanity defense.
Was there any evidence of what the time, I guess, or the fact, first of all, that he went to prison and how much time he spent in prison between the two kidnappings?
No, there was no evidence at all presented, Your Honor, to show that he had even been convicted, punished in prison, or anything. The only evidence that the government presented was testimony about the details of the prior kidnapping from A, the victim herself, and B, two police officers that worked with the victim afterward. Again, no testimony or evidence of any kind to show that he was convicted or punished in any way for that prior kidnapping. So there was no way it was going to be relevant to whether Mr. Dekoff understood it was wrong to kidnap Ms. Wagner 20 years later.
Ms. Strong, you've underscored the time gap of 20 years. Suppose we had a situation where it was 2 years, not 20 years, and there had been an acquittal on the first charge, and the similarities continue to exist, as Judge Evans has pointed out here. Why isn't that in aid of the position that the person is insane? Because you're offering insanity off of this factual basis.
Sure.
Why isn't that advanced the argument? I mean, one can question why the government might even put it in. If I understand your argument of their motive, but why isn't that supportive of irrational conduct if it happened before?
It's a matter of context. Here, it was the government presenting the evidence as part of their case in chief. Had the defendant wanted to introduce this testimony to show that he, in fact, was insane, that this is just, you know, evidence cumulative of his insanity, that should have been his prerogative. It should not have been up to the government to introduce it and then put the defendant in the position of litigating his state of mind 20 years earlier to show that, yes, indeed, he was insane at that time. The government should not be given free rein to introduce these sorts of bad acts simply because it could in some way aid the defendant. It's an unfair burden on the defendant to have to litigate his state of mind for a crime that takes place, in this case, 20 years earlier, but even 2 years earlier. It might be very difficult, especially if that defendant had not been receiving treatment for mental issues he was dealing with at that time. Moving on to our second point of error, the district court here also abused its discretion when it allowed the government to present testimony from an expert that Mr. Dekoff told her he knew it was wrong to kidnap Ms. Wagner. The government expert here first testified that she examined Mr. Dekoff for the purpose of preparing an opinion as to the nature and wrongfulness.
I think that Rule 704 only precludes the expert from saying it. This person knew right from wrong, not that the person made a statement that was completely inculpatory.
Your Honor, Rule 704B prohibits an expert from giving an opinion or inference as to the ultimate issue the defendant's
state of mind.
You
can't do that.
But
if somebody is going in and says, you know, well, I absolutely knew what I was doing, and this insanity defense is a farce. You're saying Rule 704 would prevent the witness from testifying to that?
What I'm saying here, Your Honor, is that this, again, is an issue of context. The expert testified that she examined Mr. Dekoff for the purpose of preparing an opinion as to his state of mind during the Wagner kidnapping. The government then asked her to relay what Mr. Dekoff had said when she asked about the night of the Wagner kidnapping. The first and only thing out of her mouth was that he said, "When I kidnapped the girl, I knew it was wrong." This was essentially a backdoor way of giving an inference about his state of mind.
The rule would prohibit her from saying, "I examined him. Did he tell you things? Yes, he did," without saying what it was, and then saying, "After examining him, it's my opinion that, I believe clearly that he knew right from wrong." Now, that would be violative of Rule 704, but I don't see how the statements that he made would not be admissible under that rule.
There's no case law that addresses whether an expert relaying statements of a defendant does constitute an inference as to the ultimate issue. Again, I would just submit that it's a matter of context here. When she's asked, "What were you doing?" and saying, "I was preparing an opinion," and then replying, "He told me he knew it was wrong," and saying nothing else, that creates an inference that a reasonable jury could interpret to mean that she, as an expert, believed that Mr. Dekoff knew it was wrong to kidnap Ms. Wagner. As to our third point of error, the district court erred when it refused to give a jury instruction on the nature of a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity. Such an instruction is warranted when a witness states in the presence of a jury that a defendant could go free if found not guilty by reason of insanity. Here, again, Dr. Stribling, the government's expert, testified on cross-examination that Mr. Dekoff told her he believed he could just get time served for this kidnapping. This was misleading information. There was no way he was ever going to get time served for this offense, especially since he had already admitted in closing statement or an opening statement that he had, in fact, kidnapped Ms. Wagner. This misleading information was stated in front of a jury by a witness, Dr. Stribling. As the Supreme Court recognized in Shannon versus United States, jurors often do not understand what it means to find a defendant not guilty by reason of insanity, so they may be led to render a guilty verdict for fear that otherwise the defendant will be set free. Dr. Stribling did not testify that Mr. Dekoff was delusional or incorrect, so the jury may have been left with the impression that he would indeed be set free if they returned a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity. Your Honors, it would have taken the district court less than 30 seconds to give the one-sentence instruction that Mr. Dekoff requested, and the jury would have been more likely to understand the true consequences of a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity had the district court simply read the one-sentence instruction. There's no conceivable reason.
Was there an argument by the defense? I mean, that's a typical defense argument in an insanity case, to say, members of the jury, if you find he's suffering from a mental disease or defect, he's not going to walk out of his courtroom today. He's going to...
It's still information...
Did the defense lawyer tell the jury anything about this?
I don't recall, and he would have had a chance to do it in closing statement. I don't believe he actually said, "Your Honor, Dr. Stribling made this statement relaying what Mr. Dekoff said, and he was wrong." But nonetheless, this was misleading information stated by an expert cloaked in a patina of respectability because of her status as an expert that Mr. Dekoff could get time served. And a jury instruction was warranted. It would have been simple and quick to correct any possible misperception on the part of the jury. Your Honors, if you have no more questions, I'll close by saying, for all these reasons, we ask that you reverse Mr. Dekoff's conviction and grant him a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Strong. Mr. Cox?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin, I guess, by addressing one of the comments made by Ms. Strong, that somehow it was unfair to litigate Mr. Dekoff's state of mind in this case. Well, quite to the contrary, Mr. Dekoff's state of mind was this case. And it seems a bit odd to argue, on the one hand, it was unfair for the government to put in evidence bearing on his state of mind at the same time when that became the only issue, It was the only issue in this case from the time that Mr. Dekoff's attorney filed his notice of insanity. It was the only issue in this case from the moment that Mr. Dekoff's attorney began his opening statement by saying, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client committed a horrible offense. His acts were horrible. Those were his words, horrible. But he was insane at the time he did it. I ask you to keep an open mind as you hear all this testimony that's going to come in so that you can determine what his state of mind was at the time he committed the offense. So state of mind was the issue in this case. Now, I know this court considers many, many 404B cases that come before it, and I'm sure you wish that you didn't, and I, quite frankly, as a government attorney, I wish I didn't argue so many of these in front of this court. But I guess one thing I would want to point out in this case is this is just not the typical 404B case. This is very unique in many ways, and for a couple of reasons, but primarily because the concerns of 404B, that the jury is going to convict the defendant based on some extraneous material, that they're going to find he committed the offense because of some extraneous material, the prior acts or the prior convictions, was simply not at issue in this case because the defendant admitted he committed all of the acts necessary to find him guilty of the kidnapping. So this is not the typical 404B case to that extent because it doesn't have those same concerns. But more importantly in this case, this was highly, highly probative evidence of the defendant's state of mind. When we're talking about a defendant's state of mind, it's very difficult to have any kind of direct evidence addressing knowledge, intent, those kinds of issues, whatever state of mind in its most general sense. It's very difficult to have direct evidence on that, which is why this court and others tend oftentimes, when you're talking about knowledge or intent, to allow the government to put in other crimes evidence. In this particular case, this is as close to direct evidence as you could get. A defendant who committed virtually the same act before, committed in virtually an identical fashion, and was apprehended by the police. Now, my opponent is absolutely correct. There was no evidence before the jury that, in fact, Mr. Dekoff was convicted of the offense, but there was certainly evidence that after he committed the acts, he was apprehended by the police department and he confessed to the commission of the crime. So the jury certainly knew in this particular case that he had committed the acts and law enforcement officers had responded to it, as opposed to maybe mental health professionals or someone else. So it certainly offered highly, highly probative evidence that he could appreciate the nature and quality of his acts and certainly appreciate its wrongfulness, which, after all, was the sole issue in the case. Turning to the 704B matter, if there are no questions with regard to the 404B.
Now, what was the outcome, Mr. Cox, then, in the first case?
In the Indiana kidnapping, Your Honor? If I recall correctly, initially he raised the insanity defense in his Indiana kidnapping. He was convicted. It was overturned on appeal. When he came back and entered a plea to the charges stemming from that kidnapping, he did not raise the insanity defense at that time. So his conviction solely was based on a finding of guilt, having nothing to do with regard to the insanity defense. With regard to the 704B issue, Judge Evans obviously, I guess, basically stole my thunder, but the plain text of... Pardon me?
He does that with us all the time.
The plain language of the rule doesn't exclude this testimony. There's certainly, my opponent keeps talking about you have to put it in context. Well, putting it in context, there could have been absolutely no confusion to this jury about whose statement this was. The psychologist testified, I asked Mr. Dekoff after I read him the charges, tell me about these, and he said, I did it, I knew it was wrong. There was no confusion on the jury's part that the psychologist somehow was expressing this opinion. This was clearly identified as a statement coming from Mr. Dekoff.
Why don't you talk about the instruction, the failure to give an instruction on the consequences of a...
Certainly, Your Honor. As an initial matter, of course, the only reason it even comes up is because of the cross-examination of the defendant. Now, I'm not saying that decides whether or not an instruction should be given. But the way it came up was because...
I think that instruction should be given.
Okay, well...
And I gave it when I was a trial judge. I don't know why the government would object to an instruction like that.
I think, well, Your Honor, I guess I go back to the Shannon case, and what the Supreme Court says is essentially in the criminal system, we have very defined roles, and when the jurors are not to allow the potential consequences of their fact-finding decision to influence at all their decision with regard to the ultimate issue that they're called upon to determine. And then they carve out an exception.
I understand all the policy reasons on not telling juries the effect of their verdict, but I think there ought to be an exception in these cases where a mental disease or defect is raised, because as counsel points out, a lot of jurors think, geez, if we find this guy's mentally not responsible for committing this crime, he's going to, you know, be on the corner waiting for a bus tomorrow morning, and we're all going to be in danger.
I understand that concern, Your Honor. I also understand that if any of the parties make an issue of it or make any suggestions like that, of course, we have a far different situation. That wasn't the situation here. In fact, no one commented upon that fact in any of the closing arguments, so that it wasn't highlighted for the juror.
So the defense lawyer, I haven't seen the closing argument transcript, but so the defense lawyer never mentions to the jury that, you know, this guy's not going to walk out of here if you find in his favor on this.
I don't recall that the issue of what would happen as a result of whatever the jury's verdict was in this case was discussed by any party, Your Honor. So it simply wasn't an issue for the jury, and therefore it was appropriate, in my view, for the judge to not give an instruction on that.
Well, they did hear something from one of the witnesses who recounted what the defendant had said, that he thought he'd be out with time served if the jury found that he was mentally had a mental disease or defect.
What he said was, I don't know how long I'll be in prison. They might just give me time served. So to that extent, Your Honor, it seems to me the suggestion is, I don't know how long I'm going to be incarcerated after I'm found guilty, as opposed to spending some time, and how much time we don't know, in a mental institution. It just seems to me that it creates all sorts of different issues that jurors, unless the issue is starkly placed in front of the jurors, that it's an issue that we're better left unsaid. After all, I mean, we presume that jurors don't think about the consequences of their verdicts all the time. And we may have cases that are mandatory life, for instance, and we certainly don't want the fact that they know what the ultimate punishment is going to be to distract them.
No, I understand that. I know we don't want to tell jurors that there's a 10-year mandatory minimum prison sentence if you get convicted here. But it seems to me in mental disease or defect cases, that's a completely different situation. I know a lot of district judges will give that instruction. And many times U.S. attorneys, prosecuting attorneys in state court, don't object to it.
Well, I didn't try the case, so I can't tell you the thought process of the trial attorneys with regard to an objection. I mean, obviously Judge Mim didn't think it was appropriate in this particular case either. The other thing, it seems to me, that potentially opens up a can of worms, and this is just to try to respond to you because I certainly understand what you're saying, is that, in effect, if a defendant in the federal system is actually found not guilty by reason of insanity, they're really only committed for 40 days. I mean, that's all the law allows them to be committed. Then further proceedings have to occur. So, I mean, I suppose
but you can spend the rest of your life. I mean, it all depends.
You certainly can. We've had a defendant who probably will serve the rest of his life in a mental institution.
They just let John Hinckley out just recently. Assassination attempt on President Reagan.
I understand your concerns, Judge Evans. I guess the only thing I can say is it's not mandatory, it's not required of the district courts, and we ask the district courts to use their discretion. And in this particular case, after fully hearing from the parties, Judge Mim determined that it was not necessary in this case, and we think that's a supportable decision. If you have no further questions, then I'd give back the balance of my time. Thank you very much.
Just briefly, Your Honors, we disagree with the government's contention that it was unfair to litigate state of mind. What we're saying here is that The prior kidnapping was irrelevant to Mr. Dekoff's state of mind. There was nothing in the testimony as it was presented that touched upon his state of mind when he kidnapped Ms. Wagner or whether he was suffering or not suffering from a mental disease or defect. It's a matter of relevance and prejudicial value substantially outweighing whatever minimal probative value this evidence might have had. With respect to the 704B issue, again, I just submit that it's a matter of context. When this expert gives one statement that Mr. Dekoff said he knew it was wrong in the context of explaining she was examining him for preparing an opinion, that creates an inference that a jury may interpret to believe that Dr. Stribling, as an expert, believed Mr. Dekoff knew it was wrong. And with respect to the instruction, as Judge Evans pointed out, lots of courts give this as a matter of course, and here there was potentially misleading information to the jury that could have been cleared up with a one-sentence instruction. This instruction doesn't create new issues for a jury. If anything, it resolves any possible misunderstanding. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks to all counsel. Ms. Strong, I want to extend on behalf of the court an additional thanks to you, your co-counsel, and the your firm for so accepting the appointment and ably representing Mr. Hemmer.